This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an astrophysicist explains how the recent breakthrough in fusion energy has allowed scientists to study stars and distant planets from inside a lab. Now, Republican State Senate Leader Devin LeMahieu said earlier this month that members of his party are close to supporting a medical marijuana program in Wisconsin. It's the first time Senate leadership has opened the door to legalizing pot of any kind in the state. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss previously voiced his support for limited medicinal marijuana. Both Voss and LeMahieu say any legalization would come with restrictions to limit the use of the drug to those with severe chronic medical conditions. 36 states have medical marijuana programs, including our neighbors Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois. 21 states have fully legalized the drug. We're looking now at how other states handle the issue and the options available to Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Wisconsin legalize medical marijuana? What conditions, what fine print would you want to see on that? If so, would you like to see the state legalize recreational marijuana, not currently on the table for leading Republicans in the state? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you've experienced medical marijuana programs in other states around the country, love to hear your perspective on how that worked. 800-642-1234 is the number. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Alex Kreit is an assistant professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He's the author of the casebooks Illegal Drug and Marijuana Law and Marijuana Law and Policy. Alex, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into Wisconsin here, can you give us a sense of the range of medical marijuana policies around the country?
Yeah, so, you know, roughly speaking, there's kind of two categories. The first in the category that you talked about, with the 36, I think now maybe even up to 37 states with full medical, that's medical marijuana that's not limited to what you call CBD only. So medical marijuana that would include THC-based kind of medical marijuana. Then there is another category of states that have what you would call CBD only types of laws, and those are much more restrictive. Within the, you know, sort of states with what many would refer to as sort of full medical marijuana programs, there's kind of a range as far as how restrictive they are in terms of the types of medical conditions that would qualify, whether physicians need to go through a particular kind of certification process or training to recommend medical marijuana. And then there are a few states that have some limitations on the types of medical cannabis that can be distributed, specifically limited things like pills or oils, gels, not allowing for sort of plant form medical marijuana to be distributed. Minnesota, as an example, used to have that kind of a limitation. I believe it was last year or the year before that they lifted that and extended it to plant form distribution.
All right, let's get to Wisconsin now. Here's State Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Republican, talking last week on WPR's morning show about the kind of legalization he says he could get behind. Here's a listen.
I support a form of medical marijuana where it is very restricted, so it's only going to folks who have a true medical condition in a way that guarantees that we don't have any kind of being taken advantage of. So I think we could certainly try to find some consensus on medical marijuana, but the idea that Wisconsin needs to have recreational marijuana, I just don't support that.
Now, we don't have specific legislation to refer to now, but between that and the state Senate majority leader saying we're talking about like palliative care for cancer here, not like, you know, a routine back pain, things like that. Is that normal, Alex? Is that more stringent than you've seen medical marijuana laws in other states?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like it would be on the more restrictive end for sure. And the devil's in the details, right? So I think a lot will depend on what specific medical conditions that, you know, end up on the table. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, most medical marijuana states do have, relatively broad, even in sort of more restrictive states. So, you know, it's not just limited to cancer patients or terminally ill patients. You know, there's MS, epilepsy, Crohn's disease, PTSD, chronic pain. Those are relatively, you know, common medical conditions that in most medical marijuana states. So, I think if it was to be limited you know, just to cancer, to terminal illness, those kinds of things, that would be very, very restrictive relative to other states. You know, but again, you know, it will depend, I guess, on exactly what is proposed.
And Speaker Voss, they're referring to the idea, I think, that a medical marijuana system could be taken advantage of by people really using it for recreational purposes. How have states that have, you know, more or less full medical legislation but not recreational, how have they tried to thread that needle?
Yeah, and I think there's been a, you know, range of approaches and kind of outlooks. I think some states, certainly historically, California would be an example of this. I think there's some states that, you know, sort of accepted that there would be people who, you know, might be using medical marijuana and might, you know, get a medical marijuana recommendation primarily for what we would consider recreational use. And, you know, there wasn't, you know, I think in some states, and again, California before full legalization in that state is an example of this, you know, didn't really attempt to crack down, didn't, you know, try to limit that too much. I think just kind of accepted that, you know, as kind of a, you know, better to do that than to be too restrictive or too limiting in preventing people with genuine medical need. I think more and more states, you know, have attempted to, you know, address that through things like limiting it to specific medical conditions. And some states have tried to, you know, have been maybe more skeptical of medical conditions like pain conditions that, you know, some argue or some believe could be more likely to be, you know, where patients could, you know, as that quote said, quote unquote, take advantage of it, you know, conditions where it's based more on self-reporting from the patient. So, you know, there've been certainly, I think, a range of approaches to addressing it and a range of kind of outlooks as far as, you know, how much of a concern the state believes that to be. You know, does the state think that it's, you know, necessary to really prioritize trying to, you know, limit as much as possibly can be limited to people with legitimate medical need? Or is the state willing to accept some possibility, some potential, some number of patients who don't have that legitimate medical need, nevertheless being able to get access by feigning medical need? And our state, some states, I think, are willing to accept, you know, that possibility to a degree to have a broader, more comprehensive medical cannabis program.
We're talking to Alex Kreit, professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. Look at the ways states around the country handle medical marijuana. Wisconsin's Republican legislative leaders have recently said they are close to supporting medical marijuana here for a limited number of medical conditions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want the state to legalize medical marijuana? How stringent do you want requirements to be? If so, a narrow number of cases or more generally available to people who have a perceived need for it? Do you want to go full recreational here in the state? Have you encountered medicinal marijuana in other states? What did you think about how it was handled there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Alex Kreit, professor at Northern Kentucky University, expert on marijuana law and drug policy, looking at the issue of medical marijuana in Wisconsin after Republican leaders say they could support legalizing it here in pretty limited cases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to change when it comes to Wisconsin's laws on marijuana? Do you have questions about how other states handle particular issues or experiences in those states? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in northern Wisconsin. Mike, hi.
Hi, I think it's about time that Wisconsin does what 36, I believe, other states have done, and I'd like to take it one step further. Oregon and New York have just legalized the use of psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression, and I think the number of veterans in this country who are depressed and high suicide rate should be also on the table here. I think that would be a very good way of reducing suicide from PTSD. And John Hopkins University has done research that indicates that it's very, very reliable.
Mike, thanks for that call. Alex, the psilocybin, I think probably a taller lift for Wisconsin, but are you seeing a trend for more states looking in that direction as well? Alex, are you there? We're not hearing our guest, Alex Kreit from Northern Kentucky University, looking at marijuana policy, how it's handled around the country. Thanks a lot for that call and sharing your perspective on that. We'll keep taking your calls in the meantime. Hopefully we'll get our guest back in just a moment. We'll go to Jay now in Two Rivers. Jay, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I hope you're having a good MLK day.
You too, Jay. What did you want to bring up?
Well, the Republicans in the state of Wisconsin didn't get on board with helping those addicted to opiates until their children started dying off. And we're so far behind that it's just embarrassing and disappointing that the Republican state legislators think that they have the knowledge to override what trained medical professionals and doctors might know. And I think we should go for complete decriminalization. Thank you.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Alex, I think we have you back. Jay saying he thinks Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin a little behind the curve. Can you talk about how Wisconsin stacks up in terms of marijuana legalization timelines with other states in the Midwest and beyond?
Yeah, sure thing. And sorry about the tech glitch. My computer
decided it
was a time to suddenly do a restart. So, So, yeah, I mean, I think that Wisconsin really is, you know, behind the curve. You just have to look at nothing other than how many states have legalized medical marijuana to see that, right? That, you know, if you have a vast, you know, substantial majority that have legalized medical marijuana, and it's, you know, including some quite conservative states, Alabama, Mississippi recently enacted medical marijuana legislation. So, you know, it is something that, you know, kind of spans partisan, you know, profiles among the states. So it is, you know, in a state like Wisconsin, obviously neighboring states have it. So it is, you know, something where, frankly, to me, I've always been a little struck by the fact that it hasn't gotten done in Wisconsin, especially as we've seen more and more states and some quite conservative states where it has gotten done.
Thanks for that call. Now, Wisconsin's Medical Society wrote a letter on a previous bill saying, hang on, we're opposing medical marijuana because a lot of the medicinal uses of marijuana, they're not really tested, not really proven yet. Have you seen that reaction from medical organizations in other states as they go through these arguments?
Yeah, I think in different states, there's kind of been a range of reactions as far as how supportive medical organizations have been state by state. You know, we're in some more supportive than others. I think, you know, the issue with research has always been, you know, kind of a core point of debate and of challenge for medical marijuana. And it's frankly sort of, I think, one of the things that led this to be a state level type of reform, which is that it has been historically very, very, very difficult to conduct research into the medical uses of marijuana, in part because of its, you know, really completely because of its Schedule I status under federal law. And so these federal barriers to research, that's been sort of one of the things that drove state-level medical marijuana reform in the first place, was that there was a lot of evidence of promise of medical uses of marijuana, a lot of evidence of, you know, actual medical value of the use of medical marijuana. But it was very difficult to conduct the kind of research that you would need to go through an FDA approval process, for example.
Let's go back to our callers. Pauly is with us in Argyle. Pauly, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I totally agree with this, with your person on today. I have suffered from chronic pain for 25 years, and my doctor has told me for the last 20 years that if it were legal, she would prescribe it in a heartbeat. So it's pretty sad when American has to move from their state they live in to another state if they want to get that help. And obviously I'm not going to do it because I love Wisconsin. But, you know, so I have to kind of deal with things in my own way, which makes me feel like I'm a criminal. You know, I'm 65 years old. You know, I'm not a criminal. I just don't want to live in dire pain all the time.
Polly, sorry to hear about your long-term chronic pain. Thank you for sharing your story, Alex. I think Polly, not alone. We hear callers, and there's testimony in state legislatures around the country with similar stories just in the last minute or so.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And, you know, I recently served on a state commission in Kentucky, which doesn't yet have a medical marijuana program, and I teach at Northern Kentucky University. And part of serving that commission, we ran around the state, held listening sessions, and heard from a lot of folks just like that caller who suffer from pain or other medical conditions, don't want to leave the state, love where they live, but don't want to be branded as a criminal, want to have access to the medicine that can help them with their ailment.
And just our last few moments, you're watching there in Kentucky, here in Wisconsin, other states that you are keeping a close eye on right now.
You know, for recreational, Ohio, you know, not just because of where I'm located, but, you know, that's, I think, a state that looks poised to have legalization on the ballot this year, 2023, and I think is likely to have it passed.
Alex, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Alex Kreit, assistant professor and director of the Center on Addiction Law and Policy at Northern Kentucky University. He talked to us today about how states around the country handle medical marijuana programs. Thanks for your calls. If there's something you'd like to hear more about on this issue on Central Time or elsewhere on WPR, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org with your questions. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. She smells even worse than last year, one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
There are lots of great Wisconsin Life stories up at wisconsinlife.org right now, including an investigation of the Trolls of Mount Horeb by Central Times' own Tim Peterson. Head over there and find out why that Wisconsin community is the troll capital of the world. It's got some cool pictures of the trolls, too. Find it online at wisconsinlife.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, some Wisconsin communities are pushing back against the large-scale livestock farms, often called CAFOs. But their authority in many cases is limited by state law. Find out why local governments can and can't do and why that is, and meet one community where this is a big issue. And if you have questions or if this is something facing your community, we'd love to hear from you. You can get the conversation started right now via email. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your questions or experiences. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 7. That's here on the Ideas Network. Every Friday, we talk about food here on Central Time in a segment we creatively call Food Friday. A lot of times, I take what I heard on Food Friday and put it into action right away. Like last Friday, we talked about salad with the author of a new cookbook called Salad Freak. And on Friday night, fresh out of that salad conversation, I went right home and grilled some brats. Okay, so it didn't match up, but yesterday, my wife made a lunch and we need a little something to go with it, so I made a salad. I followed our guest's advice on how to wash the lettuce. You totally immerse it in the water in the salad spinner, then drain it, then spin it dry. And I made my own dressing like she recommended. Super simple. Olive oil, fresh squeezed lemon juice, bit of soy sauce, salt, and pepper. Looked for a special ingredient in the fridge. We had a jar of capers, but they smelled really bad. They were like 8 months past date. I threw them out. We did have some grapes. I cut thin slices, tossed them on top of the dressed greens. We still have some fancier salad recipes up at WPR.org/Central Time. It's food news I can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from the new DNR secretary appointee here in Wisconsin about his first few weeks on the job and top priorities for the agency. First, a couple weeks back on the show, we looked at a new fusion technology breakthrough using lasers to start a fusion reaction to create energy. It's still a long road to usable fusion energy in our daily lives, but that same kind of laser technology is already useful for astronomers. Our next guest is using the same kind of high-energy laser technology to study the stars and distant planets from inside his own lab. Adam Frank is the Helen F. and Fred H. Gowan Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester. His latest book is Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, we had this apparent big breakthrough in fusion. Why are you, as an astronomer, excited about that?
Well, I'm excited about that development as a, as a citizen of the earth, because it's been a long, long time that we have dreamed of being able to use the same mechanisms that the sun uses to generate energy here on earth. I mean, literally from the 1950s, people started thinking about it. And there was this joke that fusion was always 20 years away, but that breakthrough was the first time it was done in a lab. It showed that it was possible. And so there's still a long route to building a reactor that you could power a city with, but just showing that it was possible in a lab was a milestone we had to cross.
But then it turns out if we're trying to get the same energy source as happens in the middle of a sun, that might let people like you study what happens in the middle of the sun. How can you put that into action for your research?
Yeah, so the amazing thing is that these, in order to make fusion work in a lab, you have to, or at least one way of doing it, is by using these huge, factory-sized lasers to squeeze a target down to conditions, temperatures and densities that you get in astronomical environments. And so even on the long road towards the milestone that we reached this year, 20 years ago, we started using these lasers, these giant machines to get to do experiments where we brought targets up to astrophysical conditions to study things like what happens when a star forms, or what happens when two giant clouds of interstellar gas slam into each other. So it turns out that these, since you're already trying to get astrophysical conditions in the lab to make power, you can just make those astrophysical conditions and study them as a way of for the first time actually having direct contact with the stuff in astronomy, as opposed to just looking through a telescope.
Yeah, you wrote a piece in The Atlantic, Adam, and I got the gist that you and fellow astronomers are a little jealous. Chemists can fiddle around with test tubes, and physicists and geologists have their things, and then you mostly only get to look at things from very far away. How exciting is it for you to be able to do some of this stuff in a lab here on Earth?
Yeah, well, so the really interesting thing about astronomy is it's an observational science. So you never get to tweak anything. You just basically, look through the telescope, you capture a few photons, beat them to death so that they give up their secrets. But you never have a chance to say, well, what would happen if that star was a little bit bigger? Or what happens if that gas cloud was a little bit more dense? So being able to actually do experiments where you run the experiment, look at the data, and then go back and change conditions, that was just not in the cards for astronomers. And remember that astronomy is a very old science, right? It goes back, thousands of years. So this is the first time in the entire history of the field that we're able to create kind of macroscopic conditions, enough of the stuff that we can really poke around in it and begin to see sort of how this stuff would behave under different kinds of conditions and answer new questions.
So what are some of the biggest questions? You hinted at a couple of them there that you're hoping we can use this same technology we use for fusion here, again, to gain that understanding. Let's stay with stars for the moment.
Well, okay, so with stars, when stars form, you get a giant gas cloud that collapses on itself. And what's really amazing is you get this material falling down onto the protostar, but you also get these jets. You get these supersonic beams of gas, of plasma, streaming out at 500 kilometers a second. And they're very mysterious objects. Why do they form? What happens when they form? And you can actually create little versions of these, that are like a centimeter across inside the lab, but they're moving at the right speeds and they have the kinds of physics involved that you actually see in the one that's a light year across. So we can actually keep running these experiments in the lab to understand the physics of these hypersonic magnetized plasma beams.
We're talking to Adam Frank, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester, looking at the same technology you may have seen headlines about with fusion energy. It's letting us, well, astronomers anyway, do experiments here on Earth to understand what happens in the middle of stars. And Adam, in that piece in The Atlantic, you wrote, there are some planets, these really big, super Earth-type planets that we keep spotting elsewhere. We can use some of the same technology to know what's going on inside of them.
Yeah. And that's the stuff that really gets me excited right now. So, we, throughout all of human history, we had no idea whether there were any planets out there other than the 8 orbiting the star. It could have been that planets were incredibly rare. Turns out they're dime a dozen. There are planets, every star in the sky has planets orbiting it, which means those are places where you might get life, right? So we're really interested in the conditions in some of these planets that we found. And it turns out the most common kind of planet in the universe is one we don't have in our solar system. It's called a super Earth, and it's a planet that's maybe two or three times the mass of Earth. And that's big enough that we don't really know what the conditions inside a planet like that are. Will they produce plate tectonics? Will they produce magnetic fields? All these things that actually have turned out to be very important for evolution on Earth. So what we can do with these in the laboratory is we can take stuff that we know will be inside a super Earth and squeeze it down to the conditions that are deep, deep, deep in one of these planets and see things like, well, does it flow? You know, is that material going to flow, you know, distort? So that would be the kind of thing that would tell us, oh yeah, maybe you'll get plate tectonics in that kind of system. Or does it conduct electricity, which will help us tell us, do these super Earths have magnetic fields, which are very important for protecting life? Now, these new experiments we're doing are taking us, they're kind of a new kind of telescope to see inside this entirely new class of planet that we've discovered in the universe.
Yeah, one key ingredient inside planets, I think you mentioned this in that piece, is iron. So like, can you literally say, let's take a chunk of iron and expose it to the kind of temperatures and pressures that we wouldn't have on Earth, but we might have inside this super Earth, and then see what happens?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. We take a little sample of iron and blast it with these, you know, 60 laser beams or 192 laser beams, and squeeze it to the point where we can see whether or not it will stay liquid. Like, when does it melt? Because that's what's really important. On the inside of, like, inside the Earth, there's a liquid iron core that rotates, it swirls around as the Earth rotates, and that's what creates the Earth's magnetic field. And it's the Earth makes, it's that field that protects the Earth from the harmful radiation from the sun. So does the same thing happen in a super Earth? And recently, some of my colleagues did an experiment where they blasted that iron, and they saw, like, oh, now we can tell how big a super Earth could be before it loses the magnetic field.
I've talked to people who, you know, with the Webb telescope, the astronomers around the world are like lining up to get some time on that. Do you have something similar to that? I know at University of Rochester, that's a big fusion laser research place. Is this a thing where you've got astronomers saying, hey, I've got this project I want to check out. Can you give me some time to blast these lasers?
Yeah, well, so the laser at the University of Rochester, which is called the Omega Laser System at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, it's actually a kind of public telescope. Like, other scientists can apply, say, hey, I've got this great idea, I want to use it. You know, can I get some shots on it? Because each shot, every time you turn on that laser, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the price is, but it's pretty expensive to do one shot of that laser. So, you know, the government has provided funds for that. And so we have a continual stream of people coming through, both astronomers and laser physicists, because they have to work together. The astronomers don't know how to use the giant laser, working together, you know, proposing projects to study everything from the inside of planets to, as I've said, you know, looking at how radiation flows through the outer layers of a star. So now it's becoming quite a popular way of asking astronomical questions.
And briefly, I assume there's a lot of computer modeling going on of the things we're talking about inside suns and stars. Are these observations, when we do these blasts, going to make those computer representations better?
Yes, that's exactly one of the things you do with this. So, you know, in astronomy, we've gotten quite used to that's actually the kind of work I do. I'm a computational astrophysicist. And so to look at something like a cloud collapsing under its own weight, a giant interstellar cloud, to form a star, what we do is we run these incredibly complicated numerical simulations that sort of animate the process and let us see what happens. But of course, we haven't had any, you know, we can't test them other than, you know, what we see in a telescope. And so using these experiments, we can actually refine our simulations and make sure the physics is working correctly. So then when we go apply them to something like a giant interstellar cloud, we have much more confidence that the computer is doing the right thing.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's Adam Frank from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester. He joined us to talk about how fusion technology is helping us test distant stars and planets in labs here on Earth. Coming up, meet the new Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources for a look at top priorities in the new year. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. In the new year, there's also new leadership at Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. You might have missed it in the last week of 2022. Governor Evers appointed longtime Sheboygan County Commissioner Adam Payne to replace Preston Cole as the DNR's secretary after Cole announced his departure. Payne has not yet been confirmed by the state Senate, but has started the job as secretary designee. I talked to Secretary Payne on Friday. Can you talk, first of all, about your personal connection to Wisconsin's natural resources?
That's a great question. I grew up in Stevens Point along the Wisconsin River, and my dad's a retired wildlife professor. And I can tell you early on, he instilled in us the value and importance of natural resource protection and enhancement. He taught us how to hunt and fish and trap. And I mean, you name it, anything in the outdoors, we did. And I've always had such a love and appreciation for our natural resources in Wisconsin, and certainly the people engaged with helping protect and enhance our natural resources. So early on, I felt as though that was instilled in me, and also spent some time on my grandmother's century farm in Sheboygan Falls. And if there's one thing I learned as a young boy, it's that our farmers are conservationists, and they do so much to protect and improve the land and our water. So I just feel as a young boy, it was instilled in me, and I'm really pleased now at age 55 to have this opportunity.
Now, there's a lot of interests involved in natural resources in Wisconsin. You mentioned hunting and fishing. There's farming. You also mentioned large and small scale, resource extraction, camping and hiking, the environment. How do you see yourself in this role balancing all those interests that sometimes align and sometimes don't?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I really feel my career, I've had so many wonderful experiences and worked with so many good people to help me develop as a professional, and just the importance of working with stakeholders and reaching out and listening to people and engaging and building consensus. And when I was with the Sheboygan County as county administrator for 24 years, I worked with a county board and many committees, advisory committees, many stakeholders, not only natural resource protection, but, you know, transportation improvements, economic development, housing, law enforcement. I mean, from A to Z. So as I enter this field and this tremendous opportunity to learn more about the Department of Natural Resources, I recognize there's no way you can learn everything. You can't get in the weeds in every single situation, but you need to listen to your staff. We're so blessed to have so many professional scientists and just tremendous, passionate, hardworking, knowledgeable employees. You need to listen to them, you need to learn, and you certainly need to engage all of our stakeholders and listen to them and build consensus. And that's exactly what I've done in the past, and that's what I intend to do as Secretary of the DNR.
One of the biggest issues we've talked about a lot on the show lately is PFAS in various kinds of water, surface, ground, drinking water. And this is, you know, border to border in Wisconsin communities facing this. How do you see yourself tackling that problem?
That's a great question. And, you know, I'm in my second week, right? And so obviously there's some orientation and just going through some of the basics to get acclimated. But I've quickly gained an appreciation for what I think is our number one priority right now, and that's water quality. And certainly Governor Evers has made that very clear as well. We absolutely have to invest more to protect and improve and safeguard our water quality in the state of Wisconsin. So as I've drilled into the PFAS situation and what a horrible pollutant this is and how many communities it's impacting and how many individual resident wells it's impacting, we absolutely have to be even more aggressive in being sure that we're making sure people can drink clean water, and that if they have this horrible pollutant come their way, that we have a quick emergency response plan of action to assist people. I recently became a grandparent, and I don't know anybody that wants to drink polluted water, and certainly don't want their kids or grandchildren to drink polluted water. And this is a growing concern in our state, and we have to invest more time and money and effort to be sure that we're protecting our water, improving it, and helping people when they need it.
Talking to Adam Payne, new secretary appointee for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Secretary Payne, that's one issue, the water quality concerns. again, you're just a couple weeks in, but what are some of the other things you see as priorities that you want to get up to speed on as fast as possible?
Well, again, good question. I mean, I'm trying to get a feel for all six divisions and the very important work they do. Obviously, our air quality is so important. Water quality, again, continues to be the area that I'm most concerned about right now. But there's some other key issues. Obviously, we have a lot of people who enjoy the great outdoors, hunting, fishing, what have you. We have a number of plans in place, whether it's the proposed wolf plan, whether it's proposals on improving parks, whether it's adding more property, stewardship opportunities. There's a lot of opportunity for improvement. And that's how I was raised. You know, I'm, again, going to listen and learn. I'm second weekend, right? But when stakeholders and our staff raise opportunities for improvement to protect and enhance our natural resources, to sustain our natural resources, to make sure that we have a healthy environment and people today and future generations tomorrow can enjoy it, I really enjoy problem solving and being a part of that and leading that process.
A story, I guess, I assume you've been following as a deer hunter yourself over the years, a chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd. I remember it emerging as this brand new thing back in the 90s. Now it seems to be endemic in many communities. Have you had thoughts as a hunter, as a local conservationist now in this statewide post on what we can do to try to turn the tide on this?
Yes, I've thought about it a lot over the years, as have my friends and family members. I've been deer hunting since I was 12 and love to bow hunt. I mean, there isn't, I just love to hunt, period, and spend time in the great outdoors, particularly bow hunting. But CWD is obviously just a terrible disease. And I sure appreciate the Department of Natural Resources efforts, particularly over the last 5-10 years, to try to get a handle on it and raise awareness with hunters and the public that, you know, you need to be sensitive about whether or not you want to consume meat that has CWD. I mean, we obviously don't know if it can transfer to humans, but is that a risk people want to take? So not only do we have to continue to inform and educate, not only do we have to continue to do a lot of research and better understand this, but what management practices are we going to use going forward to control the herd, try to control this disease, and keep people informed? And there again, I'll be relying on our staff and really looking forward in the weeks and months ahead, learning more from them on what plans they have in place and how we can better and more effectively manage this. On a personal note, and I'm sure most of your listeners, particularly, you know, people that deer hunt, it's spreading across the state just as it has in many parts of the nation. And candidly, I'm not so certain how effectively we can change that. I mean, in the past, the DNR was thinking about really knocking down the deer herd big time to try to control it. And of course, that wasn't popular, right? So I'm not so certain if we're going to be able to eradicate CWD through hunting or that type of management. But we certainly need to better understand it. And as I've shared with some of my hunting friends in the past, it'd be nice if we had a field test or something like that for CWD, where you could take that test right in the field and know whether or not that animal has it. Because so many of us have harvested a nice deer. We're looking forward to taking that animal home and sharing it with our family and friends. You go through the process of taking care of that deer in the field. You take it home and you butcher it and you cut it up and you put it in wrapping paper and all the steps that go with a good hunt. And then you get those CWD test results, and you know what, this is an animal that, unfortunately, if it tested positive, we shouldn't consume. So a lot to learn in this area.
And finally, you're an appointee of a Democratic governor. It's a Republican-controlled legislature, not always a rosy relationship, to say the least. What would you say to Republicans in the legislature about ways to find common ground and work on solutions?
I appreciate this question, because for the last 24 years working as county administrator in Sheboygan County, we didn't worry about who the D's and R's were on the county board. We really worked to problem solve. And we had such an effective team of board members and staff, and we just didn't get into those political dynamics. And when it comes to natural resource protection and enhancement, when it comes to clean water, and making sure that we can protect this tremendous resource we have, I don't think that should be partisan. So I really look forward to working with all of our legislators on what we can do to further protect public health, safety, make sure we have clean water going forward, and make sure that areas that are becoming polluted with PFAS or nitrates or whatever it may be, that we are working decisively to try to clean it up or at least help people get clean water so they can continue to raise their family and feel some assurance that what they're drinking is safe.
Secretary Payne, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
That was Adam Payne, Governor Evers' appointee, as the new Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. I talked to him about getting settled into the position, how he plans to address topics including water contaminated with PFAS, chronic wasting disease in deer, and the agency's relationships with the Natural Resources Board and state legislature. I spoke to him on Friday. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of people turn to alcohol for relief from stress and anxiety, but for many people, there's a risk that drinking will add to stress and anxiety. A doctor makes the case for cutting back for our mental well-being. Plus, we'll look at expected changes in food share benefits coming up next month. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Consumer Price Index shows inflation is slowing down, and economists tells us what that means and why we're seeing that decrease in inflation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.